Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
I know what this connector is, and I know what this connector is, but where does this one go?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I am your host, Chuck Tomasi, and with me is Craig Stepp, bringing you another special. We're very excited to bring you another installment in our series from the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. If this is your first time listening to Technorama, thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoy this and listen again. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time in the introduction because we've got a lot of great stuff to cover in this audio tour and documentary. It's so big we had to deliver it to you in separate parts. If you haven't listened to the earlier parts of this special, you'll want to visit the website or download them to get the full experience. Without further delay, let's get back to Stan Seeler and the Computer History Museum.
What is this?
A failure, but a glorious failure. You've heard of Neiman Marcus, the upscale department store?
Mm-hmm.
They used to have a catalog that came out every year, and it would always have at least one expensive, ridiculous item in it. One year it was a gold-plated Cadillac that a Texas oilman bought. But this, in 69, it was the kitchen computer. For $10,000, you got this and a two-week training course. And you needed that course. When I first saw it, I said, where's the display? And the answer is, you're looking at it. 16 lights and switches. This came with a recipe book. So there's three of us, and if I wanted to cook meatballs for us, I'd look up the meatball recipe. It's recipe 5. So I'd type in 101 for 5 in binary.
We know that.
And then I type in 011 for there's three of us, and then it would read out 010. And I look it up. First ingredient, ground round, and it's 2, so it means 2 pounds. It's a glorified recipe calculator. That was all it was. They sold none. But they probably got buzz for it. And inside here is a Honeywell mini computer. The next model of that computer made the internet possible. So there's a distant link between that and the internet. And it just looks cool. Around this time, Singer, the sewing machine company, got into the computer business. And they had some remote job entry terminals, small computers that looked kind of similar to this in design. So I'm wondering if these guys got the styling tips from Singer.
I like the big counter area.
Yeah,
so I guess you could do something.
Chopping board.
Yeah.
The interface is just ridiculous on this thing.
Yes.
It's got registers and it's got address lines on top. This is
a standard mini computer.
It is. This is just hysterical that you could think that anything like this would fly in a common kitchen. Just an inside joke, when you mentioned 5 is 101, we close out every show with a binary high five and we say 101.
I didn't know. That's funny. I just picked that by accident. Earlier, we saw the Cisco router outside. This is, in effect, the world's first router. It's an IMP. Interface message processor. Bolt, Beranek, and Newman liked, everyone liked acronyms in the 60s and the 70s. When the internet started in 69, there were three mainframes, I think an IBM 360, a DEC 10, and a Xerox Sigma 5 or something like that. But each one of those had an IMP next to it, and then the IMP talked to the other IMP, and then it talked to a mainframe.
Yes. This is U.S. government property.
Right.
You might want to return that.
There's a Honeywell 16-bit mini computer inside here making it work. When my school, UC San Diego, got on the net in 71, we were the 35th computer on the net. We were the first with a Burroughs mainframe. And I looked around, and over half the computers on the net in 71 were DEC 10s.
No kidding.
And the reason for that is almost everyone on the net was a school, and digital equipment made equipment available to schools at a reduced price as a loss leader. And it was a clever idea, I think. So students would get out of school, go into businesses that are just beginning to computerize, and be asked if they know anything about computers. Yes, I used a DEC in school. So a very good marketing move, I think. On the other hand, they got bought by Compaq, so what do I know?
The DEC writer, this is a 2.
Those are noisy little buggers.
I had a 3 in my basement until about 6 months ago. They are heavy buggers,
and they're
too.
They're heavy, too, yes.
They're extremely heavy. I had to take it apart to throw it away because I couldn't lift it out of my basement alone. And I've got, I still have in my office several capacitors the size of soda cans from this thing. And I kept the printed circuit boards because they're nice and old arcade.
We were using one as a printed console on our HP 3000 until probably 1987, I would guess.
One of the first dial-up connections to our university computer. We would we'd be at the high school, and we would dial into the mainframe, had the acoustic coupler hooked into the...
Oh, so what year was that, roughly?
Yeah,
yeah.
81, 82?
Okay. 72, I think. I took a teletype home from school with an Anderson Jacobson acoustic coupler, and I used it. And I was living with my with a relative at the time, and she couldn't believe that I had this gigantic thing in the kitchen, and I was talking to a computer, whatever that was.
There was a magic about it.
Oh, there sure was amazing. Early mini computers, ranging from the HP 2116 or 2114.
Okay. That's like a mini fridge.
2116. Yep. It does look like a mini fridge.
It would be cool if I actually took some like this and converted it to a.
People have done that with a VAX, I know. So, and there's the famous Macintosh Goldfish bowl.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Of course, yeah.
So. A rack mounted fridge. You may have something there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can keep it from the boss. Just open it up, take a beer out, you know. Very cool in there.
There really?
People, we used to keep soft drinks underneath the raised floor in the computer room because it would chill them down.
There you go. Yeah.
Officially, we never kept beer. Nope. DEC PDP-8, the world's first modern mini computer. I say modern mini computer. It's the thing that for which the word mini computer is coined. But if you ask, what is a mini computer? And you say, well, maybe it's one or two users at most. Maybe no air conditioning, standard power. That perfectly describes a vacuum tube computer we have on display, which sold hundreds of units. So. Mm-hmm. It's not the first mini computer, but it's the first modern mini computer, and certainly the first transistorized one. They pretty quickly got this shrunk down to about that size. And again, if you're interested in reproductions, Spare Time Gizmos makes a PDP-8 look-alike. It's about the size as that, but it's only as deep as the white part of the frame, so maybe 3 inches deep. So you can hang it on the wall like a picture with functional lights and switches running PDP-8 software.
Would you call that a flat-screen mini computer?
Yeah, right. At that point, yeah.
So, but it's a pretty neat product. Well, okay. We cut robots.
This right here, I remember reading about the Hero Junior.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long time ago.
5 years old.
Yeah, it was supposed to be like a home computer, home robot, right?
Yeah, it was mostly a toy, but they're very valuable now. If you ever see one,
right?
So,
well, there it is.
All of these are our valuable toys now.
Well, the precursor to R2.
We just don't have a good display for robots, so we don't talk too much about it.
Oh.
I'm going to skip over that for right now.
I love
little characters, kind of fun. When Control Data started up in Minneapolis, they hired, maybe 2 months later, this young guy who had a little bit of experience, Seymour Cray. And then CDC said, we're going to go into the business of making computers. Do we know how to make computers? You know, good question. So Cray and a few others went off, and they spent a few weeks building this little character. It's about 4 feet by 6 feet or something like that, maybe half a foot deep. And that's the entire computer. It was a one-off, but they wanted to show that they're going to use this technique of using these little plug circuit boards and lots of wiring that you can see on the backside. Cray would buy the transistors at a radio supply store in Minneapolis. One day, they cost more than they did the previous week. And he said, how come? And the guy says, oh, the ones you bought last week were rejects.
Oh, nice.
But he was running them slow enough that it didn't matter. You can see this is core memory. There's 8 lines by 8 lines, so that's 64 bits. And if you count the planes, there are 6. So it's 64 bytes of 6-bit memory. That's not enough to hold the sign content. But it was enough to show that they knew what they're doing. So they went on. And you can see there's lots of wiring behind it. We'll talk about that in a second when we get here. CDC started off making small computers and trying to compete with IBM. That's really hard to do. And IBM did some things that were perhaps overly competitive. And there was a lawsuit and Control Data won. And they refocused to being supercomputers. And they came out with the 6600, the fastest computer on the planet. This is serial number 1, the first one ever made.
Oh, wow.
And you can see lots and lots of wires here. Cray had a very conservative design philosophy. He used off-the-shelf parts, but with very good design. If he had a gate with two signals coming in, one of was getting there a nanosecond too soon, rather than putting in logic to slow it down, he put an extra foot of wire. Because it takes a nanosecond to go a foot.
Yep.
There's one spot in the back with two points about an inch apart with 20 feet of wire between them because he needed a 20 nanosecond delay.
Also,
it's a rat's nest.
It is.
But it's fast.
It's got plumbing.
It's Freon cooled, like a refrigerator. When it came out, the head of IBM wrote a letter saying, how can this company in Minneapolis with 35 employees, including the janitors, build a faster computer than we can? And Cray saw that, and he says he answered his own question. We only have 35 people. We don't have the bureaucracy and red tape. Yeah. They followed it up with the 7600, which we have over in a corner there, which is actually fairly pretty looking. And then Cray left and formed Cray Research and came out with arguably the world's most beautiful computer, the Cray One, and certainly the world's most expensive love seat.
Yeah. I always thought that was an interesting design whenever I saw a picture of it.
It's very nice looking.
Pedestal looking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is just the CPU. The rest of the computer is about as big as the CDC 600. Power rectifiers in the bottom. They got pretty hot, and the metal got hot, and that's one of the reasons they put the padding on it, was to protect people. When this was serial number 6. Normally, most of these things in this aisle are serial number 1, because we got them from Lawrence Livermore Labs. But when the Cray 1 was coming out, there was a bidding war between them and Los Alamos won. So they got number 1, which we eventually got. It's outside. You can sit on it if you want. And my guess is that Lawrence Livermore then said, well, we'll wait and let a few more get delivered before we buy one. So they got number 6. Can't win them all. But they got one of the first Cray 2s that came out. The Cray 1 is also Freon-cooled. The Cray 2 was too hot to cool it with Freon. It's liquid-cooled. If you look through the plastic while it was in operation, you'd be looking down through liquid called floor inert. It's a non-conductive liquid. You could throw a toaster into it. You'd get soggy toast, but it wouldn't short out.
Sure.
So this got so much heat, you would see bubbles rising up. So a lot of these were nicknamed bubbles. The hot liquid is drawn off, cooled off in the cooling tower, bubbles up for aesthetics, and it comes back over.
I was going to say, that's very aesthetically pleasing.
How about the red plastic flashing like racing stripes? Mm-hmm. I asked a former intern of Cray why they did this, and she said, it's very simple. You're trying to sell a $10 million computer to the head of a university, and he knows that the computer is going to be in a glass-walled room so the donors and alumni can see it. Are you going to buy this one, which is pretty, or the ugly gray one over there?
Right.
So apparently enough people went for pretty. But Cray, I think, was one of the first people in the modern era to think industrial design matters.
Yes.
And it showed. He followed it up with the Cray 3. Some of them were produced, but he kind of got sidetracked with the Cray 4, which he's standing behind a prototype or a mock-up of, and then he died in an auto accident. One of his proteges, Steve Chen, still at Cray, designed the Cray YMP. It's also liquid-cooled, but done differently. Cool liquid comes in with the blue, and then it goes through the middle of each board, and then comes out. So the boards aren't immersed in liquid. Instead, they have liquid flowing through the middle.
And I've seen a way low-level version of something like this, immersion. People were taking vegetable oil and putting...
Really?
Machines and overclocking their CPUs. So they were using the vegetable oil to disperse the heat.
That's somewhat similar to this thing, which is complete. I have a Belgian. He would say it's complete crazy. not completely, but for some reason they say it that way. It's an ETA-10. This tank held liquid nitrogen, and the computer was immersed in liquid nitrogen. So,
now that's
pretty
hot.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a hot CPU.
It's hot. And apparently, it never quite achieved the performance that marketing wanted and was claiming. So, it wasn't really a commercial success. But so far, the quest for speed has been build one processor, run it as fast as you can, deal with the heat issues. Maybe it's 2, 3, 4, maybe 8 processors, but the basic design is uniprocessor. Oh, in the 60s, Daniel Slotnick at Illinois said, can't we do it differently? What if we took hundreds of ordinary processors and ran them in parallel? Mm-hmm. And he eventually got funding from Burroughs and ARPA, and at the University of Illinois, he built the Iliac 4. They ran out of money and time, and they only got 64 of the processors, and that big box is one processor with semiconductor memory. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's Fairchild's first ever semiconductor memory on there. Again, 16K, just like the first IBM core memory.
And again, another special hardware.
And Burroughs... head project drives. So they got 64 of them, and they all talked to this central thing here. They had a Burroughs 6700 or something as a, might have been a 7700, as a front-end processor. And it ran. It ran as fast or faster than any supercomputer on the planet. So, and that was at a quarter of the final design. So they knew that they had something that would work. But in 1975, those were expensive guys.
Mm-hmm.
But when microprocessors came out, that changed everything.
Yes.
Suddenly, the Convex C1, the Intel Hypercube, they have dozens and dozens or hundreds of microprocessors ranging, for that matter, the connection machine, 65,000 one-bit processors. or the Intel Touchstone Delta, which has 512 of Intel's most sophisticated processors, the i860. It was a chip they hoped would replace x86, but it failed to. But it was a sophisticated 64-bit processor in 1990. So this is a very, very fast machine.
Nicely designed as well.
Oh, yeah, these are beautiful when they're turned on, particularly the connection machine. You can just tell from the photo, they had lots and lots and lots of red LEDs, and it looked pretty.
Now that looks like Whopper.
Yes.
Actually, that's probably a lot where they got the design from.
It could be. I wish we had, I think it's Kendall Square. They had a computer that I didn't know was a computer when I saw it. I thought it was some sort of modern art. It was really beautiful. We had it on display at our old location, but it's in storage here. Mm-hmm. This is a Swiss supercomputer that shows you don't have to have thousands of CPUs. They took seven of the most powerful microprocessors around, the DEC Alpha, and it's a supercomputer. The first two coin-op video games in the world are the green and the blue, both from California, both running Space War or a Space War-like thing, and we don't know which was first.
Really?
Now, these, I've seen this one.
You've seen
before.
That one. Mm-hmm. These two are the only two ever made, but they were at Stanford at the Graduate Student Union. They were coin-op, and they were usable, so they qualify. But they weren't a commercial product. This was a commercial product, the computer space. I played one in 71 in a bar somewhere in Southern California, and I thought it was easy to use, but I was a Space War author, so
I just bought a Merlin off eBay.
There's one down there.
Well, the Magnavox Odyssey is one of the first ever desktop video games, predating the Atari, but not too many people are aware of that. I'm sure you've heard of Pong.
Yes.
The first Pong was installed in a bar in Mountain View, and about a week later, the bar owner called and said, "Take it away, it's broken." So they went down to see what was wrong with it. The coin box was jammed full.
Oh, everybody was playing
yes.
it.
So they knew it was a success.
See, any of these games right here I've seen, as a kid.
I've played not the head-to-head, but the standard one.
Yeah.
Many hours on the Mattel toys.
Did you ever have an Atari 2600?
Yes.
Not of my own, but we had a neighbor who loaned us theirs, and they never got it back.
Does that need a prototype?
I love that prototype. Wow. That's beautiful.
Yeah, we played Pac-Man. Our whole family would play, and I remember my mom getting a cramp. playing because they had to hit the button for some reason in Pac-Man on the 2600 version, and I remember her getting a cramp, and it was cool.
That's awesome. I can sing you the Merlin song.
Yeah. That's okay. First laser printer.
Look, the size of this, it's twice the size of my dishwasher.
My around a standard HP laser printer back in the late 80s. These things were huge.
Oh, I've got one, 75 pounds if I remember right. It's really bad, the first model. So I remember I was at HP and we got the first HP laser page printer, and it was the worst thing ever for the environment. We printed page after page of stuff because it looks so nice. Mm-hmm. We printed when we didn't need to print.
Yep.
It was an explosion of paper.
Hey, the first time I really did any desktop publishing, I was had a laser jet, and I forget how much memory it had on it, but I had so many elements on the page in PageMaker, I had to delete half, print it, then undelete, and then delete the other half and print that.
That shows a lot of ingenuity. This wall has personal computers, and they're in no order known to mankind. Sorry about that. From a Commodore 64, first favorite computer that sold a million units.
The Unix PC.
Unix PC. Is that a Trash 80 Model 3, I think. The Mindset is the first computer put in the Museum of Modern Art as an art exhibit. It was an IBM Almost compatible.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. The Amiga is the second sorriest computer here, or second saddest. When it came out, it was the most powerful personal computer you could buy, period.
Beautiful.
True multitasking, the only one on the planet. And it's a wonderful computer. But it wasn't a commercial success.
No, it wasn't. I actually had an Amiga 1000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was like, it depended on which circles you were in. There were a lot of people go, oh, this is the greatest thing.
Right.
And they bought some, but it wasn't just a mass market thing.
Yeah. The first animation I ever saw in a movie theater done on a personal computer ever was done on an Amiga.
Yeah.
First professional quality computer published magazine was done on an Amiga. The almost professional was done on a C64, but the first professional was an Amiga.
Oh, and paired up with a video toaster later on?
Yeah, a video toaster. It's just amazing.
Used the Compact Portable 3. I used to work at a computer land store years ago.
I had a so Portable 386 for a while.
Yeah, those are pretty cool. I like those. Trash 80 Model 3 again. This is a something which is sad. Nobody knew about this. In 1974, this is the MCM, Microcomputer Machines, there, I think Toronto, Canada. When this came out in 74, there was only one other personal computer on the market, one anywhere in the world, that used a microprocessor. It was the Micral in France. The U.S. didn't get one out until maybe number three or four. But when the Micral came out, when the early ones came out in the U.S., maybe for the next year or two, all of those had no software in them. You had to toggle in a bootstrap loader and then boot up off of paper tape or something. None of them had displays. This had APL and ROM, a one-line digital display, like 40-character display, two digital data cassettes, battery backup. So it's technically the world's first laptop.
It is
so far advanced. It's not funny, but it wasn't a commercial success. I think the problem was, in 1974, microcomputers were toys at hobbyists bought, and they weren't going to lay out about $8,500 for a real computer, because they didn't know they should. I've talked to one physicist who bought it for himself in 74. But other than that, it just didn't succeed.
You got a PC Junior up on top.
Oh, yeah.
So those, there's an Osborne.
Probably with a chiclet keyboard, but it's hard to tell from here.
That's the
IR one.
Yeah.
Now, did you say... You did say Trash 80, right?
Yeah. He said it first.
I said, you know what? Somewhere, designer for that machine goes, oh, you know? Yeah. Every time, because everybody refers to it, whether they liked it or not, they always call it.
But then it was pretty successful. And you know the story that Radio Shack initially ordered enough for them to have one per office in case it didn't succeed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so because the high management didn't think it would work, so they thought, well, if we order a small number, we'll have one per store, and we can use it as internal inventory or something.
And right around the corner, we've got...
another Apple I signed by Wozniak.
Yep.
And Altair... this is the computer that has the name for being the first personal computer because it was on the magazine cover, Popular Electronics. And yet the one around the corner was earlier, Micral was earlier, the Selby was earlier.
I'll tell you, I'd rather program on that thing than this thing.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, sorry, I forgot about the fact that I had a keyboard.
All right, Stan, 180.
Oh, wow. Stuff here, yes.
I have a work model,
a
work slate.
Yeah, same here.
And I was on a quest to see if you needed one, and here is one. This was my only challenge. I mean, I've got weird stuff. I've still got a Capro 2 in my basement. And I thought I could stump you for sure, but this is actually in better shape than mine. It's clean.
It's cleaner looking than mine, too. Mine's a little dusty at the moment.
Lovely
computer.
It had
a neat operating system on it, too.
All spreadsheet-based.
Yeah, and you could interrupt things and do other things and pop back to them. Kind of like the Palm had later on.
Yeah, it's soft key
early
driven.
Palm, early Newton.
It did not record phone messages in, but you could at least have it answer the phone.
That's great. I forgot about that.
Most of my early BBSing days was done through the modem on this.
Oh, wow.
Because you could program macros into it to have it dial up and log in. It had a macro series of instructions. So if you need the manual or anything, let me know. But you've already got one.
Yeah. And it's just a variety of PDAs of different kinds. Handles.
Stan, why do I get the feeling that I'm looking at myself in a few years? Like, we're not in this time loop or anything, are we?
Yeah.
There's too much common between us. It's scary.
It could be, yeah. Another Xerox Alto. When Wozniak and Jobs went to Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and saw a graphical user interface for the first time, it may have been a Xerox Alto they were looking at. It was a Xerox Alto. It may have been this model they were looking at. And they then went back to Apple and came out with the Lisa and then the Macintosh. And they did pay Xerox PARC.
The Gandalf.
That's an MSI, which is a competitor to Altair. It came out a few months later. And that's a rebadged MSI. Well, you want to see something obscure. This is a cool computer that almost nobody knows about because it's marketed with true HP aplomb, meaning you never heard about
nothing.
It. It's a 68000-based Unix portable. It's got Unix and ROM. Now, before modern PDAs that run on Linux, that was the only thing that had Unix and ROM anywhere in the world. And it has a built-in floppy drive, a built-in printer, and it has a little carrying case for the mouse, and you can attach external hard drives if you wanted to. And they never marketed it practically.
That was probably one of the only Unix-based portable PCs until Sun came out with the Sojourner years later.
Funny you should mention Sun. I have about 10 of these in my collection. One of them says, has an asset tag on it, Sun R&D Lab.
No kidding.
Well, it's like this one here. This is not. This is from Santa Barbara Laboratories. I've
this
never
is
heard
interesting.
Of them.
It looks
but
like two minis.
But it's got an
minis.
HP asset tag on it. Was HP reverse engineering it?
Mini
I don't know.
Computers conjoined at the monitor.
It does. Yeah, Siamese twin. But they're sort of. No, they aren't connected. But
so they're molded together right here. Yeah.
I had always assumed it was two computers, but maybe it's. two of these and one of those.
Yeah. So these days it's not too uncommon to walk into, I took a tour of EMC a few years ago, and they had network appliance stuff, they had Sun stuff, because they had to do compatibility testing with their storage subsystems.
True. Nowadays,
so nowadays, it's not too amazing to see that, but back then you kind of wonder what, you know, this was doing in HP's world. Maybe that's how they really got
their
work done.
Because they shouldn't have been using it. Well, no, they had a lot of 9000s around in those days. Because I remember seeing them there as contracting.
Don't you just love the sound of cartridge tape drive when you close it? Clunk!
I hated the HP cartridge drive.
I hated
it. Terrible.
And they just seemed so inefficient because they went forward, they went backward, they went forward, they went backward. Like, would you just streaming read
the 5 minutes between... the bigger the tape drive on the HP, the longer it took to mount. So the 600-foot one, which is the largest they made, you stuck it in, and it was 5 minutes before it was usable. It was just terrible. So, anyway, we also have an exhibit of calculators. Again, in no order known to mankind.
The bomb right there.
It's a cute one, isn't it? The HPO one, yeah. I joined HP in 79. I could have bought one in 80 at a half price because they were remaindering them, and I didn't, and now I regret it.
Yeah.
All right. Now I have to see if you have my HP.
Is it 35?
No, it's a reverse polish.
Oh, most of them are RPM.
This
is my favorite one.
I'd know it if I saw it.
This is so unfair because HP didn't market it very well. That's a computer. It's not just a calculator. It's got BASIC, but you can get fourth and assembler for it. You can connect a monitor up to it. You can connect a floppy drive up to it over HIL. So it's really very advanced, but they didn't market it. And it's got, of course, expandability like a 41C.
Now, I had a Sharp, is an EL5500. It was much like, it looked like this, but it was a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it looked a lot like that. I bet Tandy is probably, it had BASIC on it.
Yeah, Tandy OEM'd them from all sorts of people.
Yeah, I kind of outed myself on the show the other week because I'd used RIM statements and put answers to tests on it. But my teachers, they don't care anymore.
He's even got... The little professor.
Yeah, the little professor. Hey, let me ask you a question. Now, this whole area, what do y'all do for environmental controls? You know, to keep all this stuff safe, or do you know?
None of it's running. Well, there's a few in the back.
There's air conditioning, so maybe they try to keep stuff at a decent humidity or something through air conditioning and heating, just being careful about that.
I was just wondering about dust and all that. Or
that's a good question. We have people come in and dust it once a week or so.
Oh, okay.
But, let me show you... Oh, at least the deep storage area.
Okay.
You see all sorts of manuals. You can just come in and look at them.
All right.
You're right. This is like the Indiana Jones area. Filing cabinet upon filing cabinet upon filing.
See, they do have a basement.
Right. This is a lesson to me. It's mechanical stuff. So let's go down maybe this one here. Altairs. We have a few spare Altairs.
You think?
IBM 5100s, 5110s, those are great computers. MSI 80s, probably from Intel MCS, but I don't know that for sure. Some of these machines I've never seen before like that. I've never seen a metric ABC 80. I don't even know what country it's from, but it's not the U.S. It looks like it's Finland or something. I mean, they've got O's and A's.
It's got a very metallic enclosure. We've got a... Toshiba tablet.
Wow.
That's impressive.
We've got a newer tablet.
Oh, an Apricot. The Apricot Portable is a really cool machine.
I remember, I've read about those, but I haven't actually seen one.
My brother-in-law, he had a lot of early things, but he got rid of them before I met him, unfortunately.
Now, have you had any, quote-unquote, celebrities come to the museum? Bill Gates or was?
Yeah. Bill Gates certainly has been here a couple of times. I know that. Gene Amdahl comes fairly frequently, and he talks to people about his computers that he's designed. But you'd have to ask around because I don't remember offhand.
Okay.
There have been some other people from various shows. Well, the Sol is pretty neat. It's a very pretty computer. And I asked the designer, Lee Felsenstein, why they put wood panels on it. This is about the same era as Apple II, but you could buy it assembled if you wanted to, and it actually was usable as a terminal just by itself, in addition to everything else, unlike the Apple II, which out of the box, it couldn't be a terminal. You had to buy a circuit board and a couple other things. And he said that the wood was cheaper than plastic.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say that was probably my guess.
And the fact that it looked nice was sort of secondary.
Now I know where the Commodore pets go to die. Various series of them.
Oh, there are lots of different pets out there, yeah. So...
May I touch one?
Sure. That's cool. Unofficially.
The keyboard is obnoxious.
It's obnoxious.
Remember, we had somebody send a picture of one like this, and I was like, what is this? I was like, a cash register? I've seen this version, but I've seen the Super
PET. The Super PET is neat. There's two CPUs in there, a 6502 and a 6809. The reason the 6809, these all have 6502s. The reason the 6809 is in there is they worked with the University of Waterloo in Canada, and they ported all the Waterloo languages. They had interpretive languages for Fortran, COBOL,
Pascal,
and APL. So I have a couple 9000 Super PETs, and I have APL for them. So, and that's why I got the Super PET, because I like APL.
Well, now when we look at the IT crowd, we'll be able to figure out which one it was.
No, wait a minute. I don't think I've seen a VIC 1001.
Me either. Huh, interesting.
Or even this one. Look at this right here.
Commodore had a lot of models, particularly in Europe, that we don't see too often.
They couldn't design a mouse to save their life, though. Those things hurt.
And their marketing was on a par with Hewlett Packard's. My wife just retired from HP, so I can say that.
Heathkits,
oh yeah.
Heathkits, build your own.
Heathkits, yeah.
Now, the one thing about the work slate is it taught you to type well. You could not go very fast, but if you could type 30 words a minute on that, you could get onto, say, an IBM tactile keyboard and double your speed.
And then we'll go check out the mainframes.
I think all kinds of cards and interface boards.
I bet all these cards are hard to identify sometimes, too.
First commercial
dual floppy drive from IBM. Somebody got it at a rummage sale for $20.
HP, but there are Sony drives in it.
And do y'all get just a bunch of cards and stuff, and you have to try and identify that?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, like there?
Yeah, that's what I was looking at. Cause, you know, I've had PC cards, and I'm like, I don't know, I have no idea. What are the settings on this thing?
I know where I'd be volunteering my time if I lived in Mountain
View. If you were donating, you'd probably be talking to Allison, who just walked past us. I'm sorry. You want to meet Allison?
Hi, Allison. Yes, we want to talk to Allison. This is the museum we always thought we'd have when we look in our basement. Only much better. I can't find anything here that I could donate that you're missing.
Or have five up. Or if I have five up.
Believe it or not, we're collecting like crazy. Actually, we just got in, for example, the iPod prototypes. Were given to us by Apple a few months ago. So one of the things we're taking in still is a lot of prototypes.
Okay.
But then there's a lot of old machines. Some of them we want another one. For example, we only have two of the original IBM PCs, so we just took in another of those. Being such an important machine, mm-hmm. we often lend things like that to other museums. Or if, God forbid, something happens to the one we have, we want to make sure we have more than one for some of the really early important machines.
You only have two of the original model 5150s?
Yeah, that's what my curators tell me. Okay. I actually don't make a decision on what's taken. Our curators do. So
now, if somebody wanted to make a donation, they thought they had something of value, low serial number, whatever, how would they contact you?
The best way is to go to our website, and we have a nice form to fill out on our website, which actually gets sent to me, where they say what they had to donate, the model, manufacturer, where it is, how large it is, in case we need to ship it. And
in some cases, you need a full-size semi-tractor trailer to get these things here.
And we do. We send tractor trailers out. Most times people ship to us. We don't actually have a large shipping budget, but in most cases, the shipping is tax deductible since we're a registered nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And they send us all the information. I collect it. And then our curators, we have five curators. They all get together once a week and discuss the pros and cons of taking everything, because the kind of the joke of that group is, oh, it's small, we can take it. But you get 2,000 small items, and suddenly you have a large item. So.
I have one question. Can I take a picture of the IBM or the iPod prototype?
I'm not sure where they are right now.
Oh.
They're packed away.
Okay.
With all care. Right. They're not on display because they just came in. But, you know, we're planning exhibits to open in the fall of 2009.
Okay.
And I expect them to see included.
Return trip.
Yeah, return trip.
But there's pictures of them on our website.
Oh, are there? Okay, all right.
Yeah, they should be up there. One of the things I'm committed to, I update our database, and we have people volunteering to enter all the items we have in our collection, our database. We have a bit of a backlog on that, and we take a picture of each item, and then we want the public to be able to see everything we have, so our actual database, a copy of our database is searchable on our website. Right now, it's about a year delayed because we're about to release our new database out onto there. But as soon as that's up, then it'll be real time. As soon as we catalog, within a week, anything we catalog will be on the website. Mm-hmm. And we're cataloging about 1,000 items a month across the collection.
Now, how do you go about identifying things? We were just talking about a lot of circuit boards out there. And I know some things, either the company's gone
or it was just so old that maybe they're, I don't know. How do
or
you go
it's
about
nondescript.
It?
I mean, there's yeah. no manufacturer, there's no...
Yeah, I've had,
you know,
I've had Pirlo cards and something as simple as that, and it's like, I need to know the jumper settings. I have no idea how to find it. How do you go about doing that?
Well, I'm not a content specialist, and so, but I'm a museum specialist. And mm-hmm. in museums, you keep every single piece of correspondence you've ever had with the donor. Mm-hmm. And so most times we know what things are because that's what the original person saying to us said it was. First thing that happens when something comes in is our curators do a curatorial review, make sure it really is, it's in great condition, that we do want it. And then we keep that information. Now, occasionally we have items where that every item's tagged and the tag falls off. And then it's a whole search with our curators of what is this item, does it match up this item. Mm-hmm. But half the work in museums actually keeping everything these days in a database so you can identify every item, mm-hmm. moment's notice, exactly where that item is and what it is.
You've got to do a lot like what archaeologists do, catalog it and take pictures of it, write descriptions of it, and a database, like you said, because there is just a lot of stuff to keep track of.
We... 3 years ago, we had 3,000 items in our database. We've done a major effort, and now we have over 40,000 items Ooh. Cataloged. The majority of that actually cataloged by highly trained volunteers, and we're always looking for more volunteers to help with that. And they're the ones that get to find these hidden things in the collection that were not cataloged in the past that we're rediscovering in our own collection, really exciting items.
So is the computer aspect of the museum a personal interest of yours?
I'm actually my background is in anthropology, specializing in Mayan area of Latin America.
No.
So not really, but it's a great place to work.
Yeah.
And what's exciting is I meet so many people who this is their passion in life, and our volunteers often know much more about the collection than I do because my background. That's one of the reasons that we've been very successful using volunteer catalogers.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you.
We'll send you a link to the podcast.
A partial answer to identifying things is there are some groups around that they can tap if they want. For example, there's a classic computer mailing list, which is a worldwide list of...
I had an Atom. Those things were awesome.
Yeah.
Well, you're right by a broken-down cardboard box from a Coleco Atom.
I got rid of it. I've been trying to find the floppy disk for it. It's pretty hard to find because mm-hmm. it's expensive. But quite often on the classic computer list, there'll be something posted saying, can anybody identify this card or this chip or this computer?
We've passed by the official Bitbucket. Craig's got to get a picture of this.
That's where bits go to die.
So let me just show you a couple things
quickly.
Oh,
my goodness.
Now, this is the Indiana Jones.
Is the Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Things on pallets, mostly rack-mounted equipment, I would suspect.
Right. Well, like this. This is one of those original disk drives from the Ramac.
And the case is a little busted up.
And there's a third one that's being restored right now. So we sort of have a wealth of Ramacs at the moment.
Now, when you say, Ryan, we talked about this earlier, when you say restored, you're talking about to a working condition or just...
To a working condition, yeah. Mm-hmm. Most things we're not going to try to restore to working condition. Because if you do, then the problem is, what happens if it breaks? Because some parts are going to wear out. And do you start replacing with non-authentic parts? So it's a problem for any modern, for museums with electronics.
3270 over there.
There's another smaller, much smaller museum, and it's not nonprofit in the area called Digi Barn, and their thrust is to have everything working.
That was the next thing I was going to ask you about was the barn.
Bruce Dummer, I think. I actually haven't been to the barn, but I've offered to give them some things.
Oh, check out the little room.
Oh, wait, this isn't good.
Oh, here's some VAX equipment. I recognize the industrial design from behind.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah. Eventually, those will probably be boxed.
Oh, look, early Roomba. On the bottom there.
I'm trying to find some mainframe. Here's another maintenance console. Oh, wait, does this go down?
I'll take a picture of that.
Control to X14. Come in, X14.
Oh, look, Halo.
What?
Yeah,
is that what that is?
Yeah, from the game Halo.
I was taking one guy through here, and he was just wildly excited.
Oh, sure
that.
Enough. It must have been a promo thing for the video game stores.
Yeah.
Good picture.
Pretty cool.
Sorry, we're getting so sidetracked.
Yeah, this is a rabbit trail.
So this is obviously not set up for safety concerns for visitors.
We don't mind. There's another
3,000 series.
He's missing his arm.
This is the first modern, low-cost, general-purpose,
sure enough,
stack-based computer in the world. HP sold 50, 60, 70,000 HP 3000. That's what I spent most of my lifetime
they
on.
They were making 3,000 well
computers
into the 90s.
They still were in...
Descendants of this one.
if you really know the right person to talk to at HP, you can still buy a P-Risk 3000 that's new, but it's getting harder and harder because they officially don't sell them anymore. I have one client that has 1,900 users on every single day on their 3000.
Wow.
How many other computers can do that?
Did I say it again? How many?
Yeah.
I think that's the disk pack I had to destroy to get the platters out.
And look, is that another amp?
No, I don't think that's an amp.
Look at the cabinetry in this one. Isn't that interesting looking?
The curvature.
I don't even know what it is.
This is from the Jetsons.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a food replicator from the Jetsons.
This is a little more modern.
Yeah.
Cabinet,
this is
anyway.
Just storage at the moment.
SGI.
Some Texas Instruments things are relative to that.
It's very bizarre because you can go from connectors. A few years ago to 40 years ago in just a few steps. This is very unusual.
Yes, because there's no order to this.
This is great.
They tried a little bit, but then it got overwhelmed.
This is a metallic enclosure.
That's old.
That's designed to look like wood.
Somewhere there's something that looks at first glance completely like a wood desk until you realize that if you hit a secret latch, it flips up and there's a monitor and then a keyboard comes out. It's an executive
PC. Beautiful.
Oh, that's awesome.
From like 78.
A cow box.
Really early. Oh, yeah, that's true. I haven't seen too many of those. This is just an
nice
exhibit of
display.
IBM Disk Drive technology. Yeah. I think it was
IBM. That's nice.
Yeah.
I like the cutaway.
How do you do a cutaway like that?
I don't know.
I've seen it with car engines and stuff. I don't know.
That's
a good question.
Lasers.
Very carefully.
Yeah. This is the key punch I used to use.
I used to use them too at school occasionally.
All right, picture.
Those cards in my bag were punched on one of these.
Mm-hmm. We've got some older ones, though, but it's still usable. DEC PDB-12. After a while,
it's green.
The deck machines start looking similar. Yeah, they had different
it's
colors.
It's green.
Why, I don't know.
There's some windows here.
This aisle here.
Some Microvacs.
We can't get out the back end.
What is that? It's R2's brother.
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's hope it doesn't move.
It's a Dalek.
There's some interesting revelations about the Daleks in the last couple of years.
Stan, if you remember, there's that little trap door where all of the punch holes go under here.
Oh, yeah.
Great source of confetti.
We were actually warned not to use it because unlike commercial confetti, those things have sharp edges.
Oh, yeah, they could get in your eye.
Now you know. Now you know.
Yeah, and what teenager had safety on his mind?
So, let's go. Let me show you the 1401 that's being rebuilt. Oh, and there's a 3000 Series 3. Good, okay. So,
wow. So are you old school Doctor Who and Whoian?
Mostly, yeah. We didn't really get into it until maybe Tom Baker, probably. I don't remember who was the doctor before Tom Baker, but that was about when California PBS stations discovered Doctor Who.
Yeah, it's about the 80s.
Yeah. But we've been watching the new episode. I really liked Rose Tyler.
I'm more of a Martha fan than a Rose fan. Rose started to come around in the second season. She was kind of annoying in the first.
You know that the Doctor Dances or whatever is one of the early Rose ones and won a Hugo Award. I was watching just last week and I said, okay, this is going to get nominated for the Hugo.
Yeah.
One of the Martha ones.
Martha was awesome.
Blink is probably my all-time favorite.
Also, yes,
the one with the angels.
Week. Yes. Yes, that was the one I said this is going to get nominated.
Every museum you go to, they always push you through
the gift shop.
But then I wonder what kind of gift shop they have here.
I should get 4K RAM chip keychains.
Well, we used to sell the PDB 8 lookalike here, but I don't think it's available anymore. You have to go to Spare Time Gizmos. I don't get a cut. but we do have some books and shirts and pens and things like that.
Oh, here's an old key punch.
Oh, there's over there.
This is, quite the server room. Right. Stan, where have you taken us?
This is a working 1401. We've reconditioned it, rebuilt it. Took a couple years. And this is the crew, or some of the crew that's volunteered to do this work. A lot of them are ex-IBM employees. And so six of them here right now? Sooner or later, one of them will wander over.
May I take a picture?
Sure, absolutely.
This is a busy place. I mean, tape drives are running.
Well, that's actually the hardest thing for us. They were set up for 50 hertz, 220/50, because we got them from Germany, and so the hertz helped do the timing, and they were hard to get them running. and they're mechanical as well as digital, whereas the computer's just digital.
But we've got raised floor. I see a Liebert cooling system or a UPS power system. We've got some of that. This is great. We've got one gentleman working on a key punch, a couple of them working on the key punch.
Yep.
We've got one working on that tape drive over there. And they've got the...
And they got the printer working recently, too.
Huh?
Okay to use.
Says it's okay to use.
Look at that thing fly.
That's awesome.
I don't know any of them personally, so I can't just say, hey, Joe, come over and look.
1401, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they've got the documentation.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Well, IBM was pretty good at documentation.
Yeah. But probably better than the government in some cases.
They were the government.
Yeah. Hi,
so
Stan.
How are you guys doing?
I'm Chuck.
Hi, Chuck.
We're recording for an internet radio show called Technorama.
Okay.
We love talking about the retro stuff, the old school stuff. You're sitting in front of a key punch that I've probably used a few times to write some of my early Fortran programs.
Yes.
Tell me what you're doing here.
Oh, well, let me start off and say that when I went to college back in the old days, IBM hired me to repair and maintain these key punches. And somehow, after 40 years, I still remember.
Isn't that amazing? The things your brain latches onto?
I can't remember yesterday, and I'm going to forget your name, but yeah. I remember how to do this.
I'll give you a card.
So what we're doing right now is this is the read station, and we're cleaning the read station.
Okay.
What do you know about the 1401?
Not a whole lot. It was a little before my time. I came in at the 360, 370 era.
Oh, okay.
And then, which was later replaced by the 4341.
Okay. Well, back when they did card punch equipment, this machine punched the cards, and there's your data. Okay.
I have a deck of cards in my backpack in the car right now.
Cool. Don't throw it away. Yeah. And then those cards, after being punched, were sorted by a sorter to put them in order.
Yep.
And then they were merged with the old file with a collator, and then the 1401 processed them. And that's the sequence. So all these card equipment all fit together, and the 1401, they thought they were going to build 50 of them.
How many were built?
20,000.
No kidding.
Yeah. Now, IBM came up with this new machine called the 360.
Right.
And they wanted to sell 360s. Well, they couldn't sell 360s too well if they had a lot of IBM 1401s.
So issue Apple has these days.
Except that they didn't. IBM owned almost all the 1401s. They were leased out. They brought them back in and scrapped them. So there were 20,000 of them out there. Right now, there's about 4 or 5 in the world, and we only know of 2 working, and that's one of them.
Okay, we're looking at... Do you know where the other one is?
Yeah, no, there's one in Germany, and there's one in... Phil has one that worked 7 years ago when he plugged it in. But there's one working in Germany, and this one. As far as we know, those are the only 2 operational 1401s.
Is this fully functional right now?
The tape drive, well, those tape drives are out. That tape drive works.
We just saw it running, yeah.
Yeah, and everything else works.
And what do you expect to do with this once it's operational?
We expect to have people come in from radio stations and interview us, and we can tell them about the wonderful 1401.
Yeah.
We've been successful so far, haven't we?
That's right.
That's one.
Yeah. For the first phase of the invasion.
Yeah, hang a second. I guess I'm going to give you.
You bet.
We do hope to have it on display so people can come see it, because we want people to see what a raised flooring looked like, for example.
Oh, he's outdone me. He's outdone me.
No, it turns out that today people see a PC with fields on it, and they put in your name, address, telephone number, and tab down. And that's the way people do things. That's
right.
The way everything's done. They don't have the concept of data in fields. Here, take that. In fields in a card like this. And so I want to bring them in here and talk about that. This is the data that gets put in the fields in the card, through the sorter, through the collator, and fed in there. And in case you forget where you got that,
his business card is on one of these Hollerith cards. Computer History Museum. I love it.
Okay.
We are headed off to the Podcast and New Media Expo on Thursday. It's down in Ontario, California. This is the third annual one. The first year I came with a deck of these and I collected autographs on punch cards, and everybody remembered that.
Oh, it was a great conversation starter.
Yes, it would be.
Yeah, it was.
But to have a business card with it is one step better.
Well, what we'd like to do is when people walk away from here, we'd like to have them have some idea what unit record equipment is and what the 1401 is, and that's what that card is for. And if you have any doubts, show it to your friends and have them come down here and see it too. Awesome.
You've handed me a data card, which has
data,
some type of serial number, and then several fields over, a name, and then some kind of account number. This is beautiful. I feel like I've come home.
No, so you come home, but I've been here a long time.
Yeah, to my house.
I don't have any of my cards with me.
Okay. That's fine. Stan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good luck.
Good, Stan.
Okay. Anything else for now?
Stan, this has been a real treat.
I
appreciate
with you guys.
It.
Thank you very much.
You had some good questions too, like the capacity on the RAID. Nobody's ever asked that.
I'm going to be waiting for the connector exhibit when I come back.
I'll tell them that you asked about that.
We have definitely got to come back. Thanks again.
Well, thank you.
We want to thank our docents Stan Sealer and Robert Stetson for setting the whole thing up. We had a great time and encourage you to visit the Computer History Museum if you're in the Silicon Valley area. Look them up on the web at computerhistory.org. Thanks for listening to Technorama. If you have any comments or feedback about this or other episodes in the U.S., give us a call in the listener line at 206-222-2428. An easy way to remember that is 206-222-CHAT. If you're outside the U.S., we recommend using Skype for free computer-to-computer calls. Just download Skype from skype.com and add ChuckChat to your buddy list. You can also send us an email at technorama@chuckchat.com. We'd love to hear from you. Technorama can be found at chuckchat.com, where you can find out more about our regular show and how to get it automatically delivered to you. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with Farpoint Media and all the great shows there. Visit them at farpointmedia.net for a great collection of audio content. Thanks for listening. Share Technorama with a friend. And until next time, a binary high five.
101.